all. Welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm the editor of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press that publishes socially engaged or socially conscious literature. All our books are free to readers, so if you would like a free novel, collection of poetry, or a collection of essays, you know, all you have to do is go to our website, kidraconis.org, kidraconis.org, and, you know, surf around the page, find out what books we've got coming on, what books we publish, and what's coming up, and, you know, just send me your mailing address, and I will happily send you a book free of charge. All our books are also available in ebook format, so if you just want a free digital copy, that's cool. Free digital copy with an asterisk, because you can't sell books for free on Amazon, unfortunately, but every other ebook platform, it's free. So unfortunately, our third man, Chris Malmberg, scrag dogged us today, so he's not going to be with us, so we are not going to talk about my most recent pick, Revolution of the Ordinary, which is on Wittgenstein and ordinary language philosophy and the important and its importance for literature. So today, you know, Chris, Hans, and I just decided that we would go ahead and do like kind of a do something maybe a little different. So we are going to talk about Robert Browning's Caliban upon Setebos, a fantastic Victorian poem, and it is the namesake of this podcast. It's where I got the name from for the podcast. And interestingly enough, Browning got the name from Shakespeare's The Tempest. So there's going to be a whole lot of interesting stuff to talk about, I think. What I'd like to start off with was something, you know, you said via chat, Hans, that, you know, you thought that the poem meant something to me that you never quite got. So you want to talk about that? Is that an interesting
topic to you? Sure. And I might say ahead of time, just as a warning for listeners, and maybe your plans on how to handle this are different, Patrick. Maybe you're going to approach this differently than I am. But there might be a certain amount of nostalgia mongering or plunging of our heads into our own asses here.
Yeah, there might be.
Because this, I mean, this poem is, my impression at least, is it's of pretty great personal significance to you, and was one of the, you know, your interest in this poem was one of the first things that I knew about you. And I have the general impression that it is, if not something that has shaped your worldview, at least something that reflected your worldview at a time when you needed to have your worldview reflected.
Sure.
When you were looking for something like that. And mm-hmm. that it's been influential aesthetically, if not philosophically. I have this memory. Maybe this is too personal, or maybe this is just flat out incorrect. But I have this memory of I first met you at the University of Alaska 11, 12 years ago, and I have this memory of you carrying around a tape recorder and reciting poems into a tape recorder. And I believe that this is one of the poems that you would recite into the tape recorder and then listen back. And that practice was very striking to me, because there was a value that you placed on the aesthetics of language that it had never really occurred to me to place before. And it's easy to make fun of now, but at the time it was very striking, and I admired it. There was a kind of unself-conscious, unironic engagement with language that I thought was really cool on your part. And so that's really, I mean, that's a lot of what the interest for me was in hearing you talk a bit more about the poem. I mean, I understand on some basic level what the ideas of the poem are, and I've read The Tempest. As far as intertextual stuff goes, too, I don't know if we'll get into this much in detail, but when I was looking up the Wikipedia article for this poem, I noted that it in turn inspired some references in Dan Simmons' work, which I think was I'd always wondered how you got into this poem, because I don't think of Browning as being completely typical of what I would have expected you to be into at 25 or however old you were. And right. And I assume that you can start at Simmons and trace that back to Browning. But that might be a step too far. I don't know.
I have read Dan Simmons, you know, some of his science fiction books. You know, I've really enjoyed, and he makes a lot of references to, before he became a best-selling novelist, he was a high school English teacher, so mm-hmm. he makes a lot of references to lit, but that's not actually how I heard of this poem. It wasn't through Simmons. It was through a freshman, not a freshman, you know, I was like a junior or a senior in my undergraduate, and we talked about this in a British literature class.
Okay.
Caliban upon Cetibus. And so that's how I remember hearing about it for the first time.
Okay. And anyway, I don't know if I've mentioned this in the podcast before or in recordings that were actually edited into the final podcast that people hear, but my wife has always been a bit skeptical of the name of the podcast.
Right.
Because it's a little insular, you know?
Yeah, it sure is.
And in my own book, that's perfectly fine. I'm very keen on insularity in the world of art.
Right.
But I thought it might be interesting to kind of have in the official record of the podcast what the full resonance of the name really is for you, why you chose it, why it seemed more appropriate for you than something like, as my wife suggested, book talking. My original
book talking's great though.
Yeah, well, I'll tell her you said that. My original idea had been to have her on and have you try to make an argument to her of why it was a good name for the podcast, but sadly she was not available. But
is she river tubing?
She's not river tubing. She's just didn't want to do it.
she's like that just sounds like it sucks.
Huh? But maybe in the spirit of that, you know, you can kind of have her as an imagined listener. This can be your dramatic monologue, as it were, and you can kind of have her as the projected listener.
Which is super interesting, because Caliban upon Cetibus is a dramatic monologue, right?
As are many Browning poems, yeah.
Right, yeah, he did that a lot.
That's his trademark thing, yeah.
So the name of the podcast, like you said, it's kind of like an in joke or it's insular, but I actually think that it reflects my previous understanding, but the kind of angle that I took to the poem when you first met me is reflected in the title of the podcast, The God Cetibus, because the press is an anarchist press. It's all about kind of, you know, decrying or critiquing or being upset about the various injustices and horrible things that are going on in the world from, you know, just the list of things that anybody could name off,
sure.
that someone on the left would be pissed about. And regardless of the angle that you take to the poem, however Cetibus is characterized in the poem, regardless of whether you think Cetabus is actually real within the world of the poem, which is something that I've actually given a lot of thought to. Cetabus is a capricious tyrant, right?
Yeah.
You know, he gives and takes as he chooses, causes harm and suffering as he chooses, at least according to Caliban. So I thought that would be like a good, you know, ironic name for the podcast.
Sure.
It's the Cetabus is a tyrant, and, you know, we're kind of trying to critique tyranny in the podcast and in the press. So I thought it fit on that level.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Do we want to talk a bit more about kind of how the poem constructs the idea of Cetabus, how the poem kind of... my understanding is that it's about the ways that... It's about the limits that humans can have in their understanding of God or of godlike creatures, and sort of the way that our own... The way that the limits of our own, that our own vices, our own faults, our own limitations in self-understanding become things that limit our ability to understand God as such.
Right.
Which is, like, I think that's somewhat of maybe only academic interest to us because, you know, we don't believe in God at all. But
Right. I think that's the original, like, way that Browning was trying to use the poem. You know, that's why we have this epigraph, "Thou thoughtest that I was altogether such a one as thyself," which is, I'm looking at my copy right now. It's from Psalms 50:21. And so, you know, the poem, I think, is originally intended as a critique of, you know, human limitation, or, you know, like, there's no way that natural theology, or, you know, what we would think of as essentially science and philosophy, you know, according to Browning, there's no way that we're ever going to understand, you know, something that's outside the scope of understanding. And we'll only mischaracterize it due to our own limitations, like you just said. So I definitely think that's the original meaning of the poem, or what Browning is trying to get out of it. And while I definitely find that an interesting, and I think we should know that, but what my main... kind of what I like about the poem is kind of an offshoot from that, and it's probably best expressed in a roundabout kind of anecdotal way. So Chris, I remember, you know, thinking about this poem, and I was writing that essay about it that you know, about killing ants and whatnot, that you know, I think is probably the most memorable thing that I wrote while I was in Alaska.
Should we just give a very brief synopsis of that for listeners who haven't read it?
Well, it was an essay called "On Killing Ants," and it was a personal narrative about first encountering the poem "Caliban upon Cetabus" in my literature class in undergraduate, and then from there it kind of extrapolates and does some kind of armchair philosophizing or whatnot. And so that's the background on that. And I was doing research for that essay, and I was reading some critical literature on Caliban upon Cetabus. And one thing that I came across, so there's a line in the poem, "Caliban upon Cetabus," where is it? I'm sure that I highlighted it. Okay, so Caliban says, "Look, now I melt a gourd fruit into mash Add honeycomb and pods I have perceived, which bite like finches when they bill and kiss. Then when froth rises bladdery, drink up all quick, quick, till maggots scamper through my brain. So that's, you know, he's describing, excuse me, he's describing creating gourd fruit alcohol, right?
Mm-hmm.
And getting drunk when it ferments. And the critical literature I read said, well, he has to be talking metaphorically. He can't be doing this in real time, because that would take, you know, days or weeks for a gourd fruit to ferment, right?
Okay.
And I mentioned this to Chris, and he said, seems like the guy doesn't understand the fantastical source material, right? And so that, you know, assuming that this takes place in the world of the Tempest is full of spirits and magic and things like that. So there's no reason to assume outright that Caliban couldn't ferment a fruit while he's talking in the poem and then drink it and get drunk.
Sure.
So it isn't that you know, I'm necessarily interested in understanding whether he actually does create mash and gets drunk.
Mm-hmm.
But that led me to the idea that this is a world in which the god Setebos, as Caliban describes him, really could exist, right?
Okay.
Does that make sense? You follow me?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah, what you're saying is that if you read the gourd fruit as having been literally fermented in real time while Caliban is talking, then you are, you can use that to justify a larger assumption that our rules of natural versus supernatural and of logical causality don't apply, because this is the magical universe of the Tempest that this is all happening.
Correct.
Within. Okay.
Absolutely. So, from my perspective, you know, we have Browning's original intent, which is to, you know, show how human limitations construct or misconstrue what God could actually be or actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's no real way of understanding God except through revelation or faith or whatnot. But, you know, this little tidbit that I've been talking about skews us into a slightly different direction, in which the god Setebos could actually exist. And if he does exist, he is a tyrant, and Setebos kind of has every right to be...
Caliban has,
you know,
every right.
Caliban has every right to be pissed off, to you know, be afraid, to... If, you know, if Setebos exists.
Yeah.
So that kind of more metaphorical reading has always interested me and always stayed with me. And I think it's representative of the kind of the anti-authoritarian worldview that I think I've more solidified, has become more solid in my mind since Alaska and after.
Okay.
So that's basically, you know, the basic gist of why the poem is important to me.
Okay.
Is that interesting to you, or?
That is, yeah, that is, definitely. I think it's a little bit, I'm trying to think of, so my thought about the poem had always been, or my sense of what the poem meant to you had always been that it was less about, and this is my own perspectives and biases coming in, right? That the way that I had always, well, again, recognizing that there's one thing that Browning is saying with the poem, and that's, you know, that's what we've already been over a few times. What was striking to me when I read it is, the universe, the world, whatever you want to call it, is, because it's guided by chance, because it's guided by randomness, it is arbitrary and capricious.
Right.
And nothing that happens really makes any sense. And in the absence of conscious effort, by human beings, there will never be anything resembling justice. There will never be anything resembling, nothing will have any kind of linear or moral order to it. And even when humans try to create that, most of the time will still fail, but it certainly won't happen without us, right?
Correct.
And
that's definitely something I read from the poem, like what you're saying.
Okay. And that had been, I mean, because I think that had been much more... There's a sequence in the poem where he talks about the crabs. You know, there's 21 crabs walking
right
along, and this one I'm going to yank his pincers off, and this one I'm going to give him a couple juicy worms. And that's all of us, right? We're all the crabs, and what's actually happening is randomness and chance are some of us yanking our pincers off and some of us giving worms. And
right, exactly.
You know, and into that void of meaning, you can introduce different stories. And if you're the crab who happens to have been given the two big worms, then you're going to create a little story about how you're the deserving crab and you worked hard for your two worms.
Right.
And if you're the crab whose pincers got yanked off, you're going to make up a little story about how, you know, God has a plan where you're going to be rewarded for your persistence in continuing to pinch, even though you've only got one pincer now. And in crab heaven, you're going to maybe get some worms then, you know?
Right.
And that Caliban, you know, Caliban is a sort of a brutish asshole in the world of the poem. And
right,
he's behaving like a capricious, brutish asshole. And his particular way of understanding the whole sequence is to say, well, you know, God is a brutish asshole, arbitrary brutish asshole like I am. He's pretty much just behaving toward the world as I do toward these crabs. But it's really all...
Right.
It's really all just randomness and a vacuum of meaning that people are introducing. So my own reading of the poem had been more about... That it's about the... It was resonant to me as being about the ways that we kind of assign arbitrary meanings to chance and to fate, or not fate, to chance and to things that don't actually make any underlying sense. And as I'm not as versed in philosophy as you are, so I may be about to drastically oversimplify or mischaracterize some things, right? But I remember one time we had a conversation. You asked, I think, just kind of randomly, you asked one of our professors in the little kind of quiet space right before class starts. You asked one of our professors, Eric Heine, if he was an existentialist.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I don't remember if it was Heine that said it or if I said it, but the point that emerged was that there's basically no way, if you don't follow an organized religion, then on some level you have to be an existentialist, right?
Right.
There's no other way to intellectually exist. And
absolutely.
I don't know about you. The one of the ideas, as I understand it, of existentialism is to say, well, you know, you have to make your own meaning. And there's a way in which for me at least, for a long time I kind of had the instinctive habit of thinking of that meaning making as intrinsically noble or as a noble activity, right?
Right.
Probably partly because you and I, in the environment that we were in, we kind of were designated as like the, or we were self-designated as the kind of chosen meaning makers of society. So we had
right
to perceive that as a meaningful pursuit, or right, not as a meaningful
right
pursuit. We had to perceive that as a noble pursuit. But in fact, you know, if you're the crab with two worms and you're saying, well, Didn't I work hard for my two worms? That's a way of creating meaning. It's a way of doing that meaning-making activity that's probably on the net a negative social benefit. It's an ignoble way to exercise that intellectual process.
Yeah.
And I think definitely... the poem, to a certain extent, resonated to me a bit as a critique of that or as a way of thinking about that, even though I'm sure Browning, we're way outside now, you know.
Yeah, I don't think... Yeah, we're not talking about what Browning thought anymore, I don't think. But that's okay. I mean, I'm all right with... I mean, I think it's important to understand what the original use of an artwork is or to make sure that you're responding to it at least in some type of ethical way. And I don't think we're responding in any unethical way. We're pursuing some other line of inquiry.
I mean, we are using the podcast to launder money. So,
yeah, that might not be so ethical.
If people are wondering why we have $100,000 a month in ad revenue on this podcast, that's actually why, because we're laundering drug money. But beyond that, we're not responding in an unethical way.
Right. Other than you know, profiting off of the suffering of others.
Right.
But yeah, that's an interesting. That wasn't something. I definitely agreed, like, that the way you characterize the poem is about randomness and how we respond to randomness and whatnot. And I definitely agree with that. That's a reading that I've always enjoyed, about this poem. I wasn't necessarily thinking specifically about how the different crabs make meaning, but I definitely think that's super interesting. But the little anecdote about asking Erik Heine if he's an existentialist, that definitely reminds me. And I still do kind of consider myself an existentialist, even though, you know, like, I no longer believe in free will.
Sure.
And I don't believe that, you know, humans do make choices, but, you know, we're not exactly responsible for those choices, not exactly.
Right.
But I still do think this idea of authenticity, which is essentially adding like a moral value to, you know, doing, you know, making meaning. So I still think that that's kind of a relevant idea, authenticity. But so the way I think of it now is, like, so even though we don't have free will, at least I don't think we do, even though I don't think we have free will, we can still do authentic things or inauthentic things. We can still do things that, you know, we genuinely want to do and genuinely believe we should do. And we can do things in bad faith, things that we don't think we should do and things that we don't want to do. So I still think authenticity is relevant in that sense. And
it's
it's
certainly a thing that we subjectively experience that is meaningful as a subjective experience.
Right, absolutely. And I definitely think that if we do something that we want to do, that is a positive, that's a, so, you know, it's really hard to talk about morality in terms of numbers, but let's say making an authentic choice has a moral value of +1, right?
Okay.
Now, like you said, you know, the content of your choice can still be bad. So it can still be bad to think that, you know, you randomly receiving two worms is the result of your hard work. So let's say that's a moral value of a -3. So ultimately we have a positive value of +1 from the authentic choice to believe something, and then the negative value. So basically all I'm saying is that I think it's still useful to talk about authenticity, and I do think that authenticity in and of itself is morally good, though certainly, you know, we have to judge something as morally good just because it's authentic. Is we can't do that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's part of a larger moral calculus,
right?
But not exactly. But not something that should be dismissed as part of that calculation.
Right.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That makes me think a little bit about. I'm going to reveal now the limitations of my acquaintance with Victorian poetry. So I took the reason that I'm even passingly familiar with this poem or with the larger work of Robert Browning's writing is the semester that you and I met, our first semester at the University of Alaska. I took a class on Victorian poetry, and the two poets who were chosen were Browning and Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Okay.
And I can't remember now the name of it. It was a notoriously difficult professor, notoriously cranky, ill-tempered. At Alaska, yeah, yeah.
I don't remember any shitty professors there.
Well, he was very good. He just, you couldn't skate by. I remember one time I don't remember what it was that Chris said, but like the first time in class that Chris hijacked the conversation to say something kind of offhandedly silly and sort of be the center of attention for making a dumb joke. After class, he pulled Chris aside and he said, "You know, you're not always going to be able to get by on everybody liking you."
I think I know who. I forget his name. He was he was my mentor one semester for teaching.
Yeah, and I mean, I have nothing. I have nothing but respect for him. I should say, if that's
I thought he was awesome. Actually,
yeah,
like he was definitely serious and definitely kind of curmudgeonly, but. He wasn't. It's not like he was an asshole, but I totally forget his name.
He wasn't cruel. He wasn't capricious. I mean, the little interaction that I just described with Chris, my sense is that that was very formative to him. You know,
right?
If he were here, he might say differently. But anyway, so that's all a digression. I was just going to say there's a concept that Hopkins had of. Inscape, this is all kind of going to be dredged up from memory. So, but Hopkins had the idea of inscape and in stress, right? Your inscape being essentially kind of your the internal shape, the natural instinctive internal shape of your soul, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the in stress being kind of the force in the world that sort of presses down to like make you want to behave in an authentic way. Right. And
right.
That if, that there's a happiness that arises from sort of the force of the inscape of the world kind of settling nicely into the in stress of yourself, of like the peg going into the hole, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's such a weird way of conceptualizing. That's such a weird way of conceptualizing kind of that same idea in a very kind of different sort of philosophically naive but a very original way, right? That same sort of the kind of abstract desire to be authentic or to live authentically. I think with Hopkins, if I'm remembering right, it's generally sort of understood in the larger kind of question of his sexuality, but you can leave that aside and still have an interesting little metaphor. So,
absolutely.
And those are the only Victorian poets I know. That's it. There's other names I know, but I couldn't talk intelligently about any of the rest of them. I mean, we're here to talk about Browning. But.
Right, exactly. I'm not knowledgeable about Victorian poetry. Really, I mean, yeah, Caliban upon Cedibus is it, basically. And I do love Thomas Hardy, but I don't. Mm. I haven't really ever delved into his poetry. So,
yeah, yeah.
Mm. Does that clear things up for you, Hans?
That does. That actually, that gives me a much better understanding. So, I guess okay. we and I have a better sense now too of why. You know, I had always kind of conceived of the fact that you called the podcast what you did. In some unexamined way, I just sort of always assumed it was like a thing where you have a thing that you like and you're trying to find a name and you're just like, well, here's a thing that I like. I'll name it after the thing
sure.
I like. You know, it's like sure. if I were brewing a beer, I would be like, well, what do I like? I like prog rock. I'll call this prog rock stout. And there's not really
right,
any
sure.
there's not any meaning to it beyond, well, I like A, so I'm going to apply that to B. And that, I underestimated you quite grievously, it now seems.
That's all right.
No.
I accept it. It's fine.
Cool.
It doesn't matter. But, yeah, I don't know. Do you think Loewen will change her mind now? Think that
well,
Book Talking's
I'll,
not as good?
I'll send her a link to the podcast and ask her to listen to it. And if she does, I'll ask her how it affected her.
Yeah. I mean, I gotta admit that Book Talking is pretty good. You know, it's just I mean it kinda is really. It's like
yeah.
it totally, you know, captures what we're doing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it speaks to, you know, it's like, hey, Book Talking, and we're not elitist about it.
Right.
Whereas The God Said of Us says something exactly the opposite. It's like, you don't even know what we're talking about, and we're fucking elitist about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. You don't know what we're talking about, but whatever it is, you probably don't want to listen.
Exactly. So ultimately I think Loewen's title probably is better to get more listeners.
Right.
But thankfully, you know, on most of the major platforms that, you know, I send the podcast out on, you know, people will search by keywords, so you know, they're like, you know, I'd really like to hear a podcast on this book.
Mm.
And so, you know, all the titles of the podcasts are simple, like on X author's book. So
sure,
they find
well,
them that way.
That's a nice compromise, then.
You know, that's why we have almost 700 listens in a year.
Wait,
of podcasting.
I'm honestly blown away that we've achieved triple digits. That's vastly.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. I mean, I don't. I just sort of had the idea that nobody was listening. Like, that's actually wonderful news.
No. We have... How long have we been doing this?
Eight months? Something like that.
Yeah
it's been a
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, we're at almost 700 total listens for the podcast.
Oh, that's actually fantastic.
Yeah, and I think... Our discussion on Don DeLillo has the second most listens at like 60 or something.
Okay. What's number one?
But one I did with Jed on Dune.
Okay.
Which kind of makes sense. Like Dune is,
yeah,
you know, it's a hugely popular book that, you know, is going to beat even Don DeLillo out.
Right.
And
Moby I guess Dick the DeLillo, I wonder if the DeLillo did better because it's about an author broadly and not about a particular book?
Yeah, that's
true. Or just
that
because
be
DeLillo
true.
Is better known? Some combination,
I mean,
maybe.
He's pretty well known. I don't know. I'm not sure.
He's pretty well known. People who are into him tend to be really into him. Sorry, you were saying
yeah.
Moby Dick?
Moby Dick was number one for a while there.
Because of all the people who were trying to find something for their research paper on Moby Dick.
Right, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, Moby Dick's pretty well known. I'm trying to think. Our podcast on Cormac McCarthy's doing well for, you know, when you consider the fact that it's only been around for half the time of the podcast and it's, you know, already number four or number five in listens.
That's a little unfortunate news to me, actually.
Oh, why?
I feel like I kind of came across like a dumbass in that particular episode. So
No, you didn't come across like a dumbass. You just came across like you didn't necessarily like the book.
I just came across like I didn't like or understand the thing that everybody was really excited to hear me talk about.
It's all right. Like, I kind of went into it knowing that, like, Cormac McCarthy is probably not your thing. You know, he's not. I mean, there's a lot of ambiguity in that novel, like a whole lot. Right. But it's not, like, funny at all. Like, it's really pretty dark and depressing. So, you know, for that reason, I kind of assumed you wouldn't necessarily like it, but. It's like, man, I want to talk about McCarthy. He's so fucking good. Why don't people understand? And I think people probably do understand, just not everyone.
Right, right.
Cool. No names mentioned, obviously.
Yeah. Who on earth can we think of that doesn't like or understand Cormac McCarthy? I almost feel in retrospect, if I had just read that to read it, I might have had a better time than if I'd been reading it like, all right, got to understand this. Got to get it. What's going on?
Oh, yeah.
What's all this mean? You know, I probably set myself up for failure by trying too hard. But
it's a super difficult book. You know, like so much of it is just in Spanish, just fucking straight Spanish. Like, what? And, you know. So.
And that part wasn't even that bad. I mean, like, I know enough Spanish that I could pretty much follow those sections. But.
Yeah, I actually found that interesting, too. I'm not a fluent, in any way, shape, or form, fluent in Spanish. But, you know, you know enough words to kind of understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
What were you about to say?
Nothing, I don't think.
Okay. All right. Well,
all right. Good chat.
So, yeah, good chat. So I guess next time, you know, Chris isn't here, but I assume that we're just going to go ahead with Revolution of the Ordinary, though you said you're having some trouble getting it.
Maybe. Well, I'll shoot you a message when it does arrive. I mean, I've ordered it, but it's one of those things where I like my... Like a good conscientious person, you know, my first stop was the local bookstore, and they had some kind of issue where, like, they couldn't order it like they normally would. They couldn't do a special order the way they normally could. And so then I went to Amazon, but Amazon only sells it through a third-party seller. And so because it's through a third-party seller only, you don't have the usual shipping options. And the shipping that
chose
is just taking longer than you would expect. So
why don't you just order the ebook? That's like immediate.
Well, I don't have an ebook reader. I don't really want to read it on a computer monitor.
Oh, well.
At this point, I already paid $35 for it. So to buy an e-reader just to read this book,
You don't have to buy Amazon Kindle on your desktop. You just download the app.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't want to read 200 pages of philosophy on a computer monitor if I can avoid doing so.
That I totally get. Like,
yeah.
I am phasing out all my paper books. I've decided to do that just because I'm either going to read it on ebook or audiobook, but you know, I totally understand why you would not want to choose to go that route.
Yeah. 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 Cool. But I'm sure I'll have it in time for, you know, I'm sure I'll have it in time for 2 weeks from now.
And if not, like, we could always, you know, contact Chris and be like, what's your choice? Because I've reread the book, and I really want to talk about it. So maybe we can just delay that option until everybody's read it. And if Chris, you know, wants to pick, and we could do Chris's next or something like that. So I guess we'll just... You know, we'll just chat through social media platforms and figure it all out.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Cool. Hans, as always, it's awesome chatting with you. And I think this was, you know, a shorter podcast, but certainly still super interesting. So awesome. Yeah. Peace out until next time, man.
All right. Have a good one.
You too.